There are a lot of reality shows on the air nowadays about dating reality shows. I mean, it all started back, probably the original one, the original dating show was The Bachelor. I mean, you all probably heard about The Bachelor. Then there came The Bachelorette because it needed a female lead role there. And then more recently, there's even a Golden Bachelor, a bachelor over 50 or 60 or whatever, I'm not sure. But that kind of appealed to the older crowd. And for others, there are other dating shows like Love Island, Paradise Island, or Temptation Island, because all these shows are bringing these singles together and tempting them and whatnot. There's even just recently I saw a dating show geared toward farmers. It's called The Farmer Wants a Wife, and it was a dating show geared to people on the farm that don't have the... Anyways... A lot of dating shows, and most of them, the concept of these dating shows is pretty simple. They bring a group of single, usually hot-looking people together, and allow them to interact in various ways and with seductions and temptations along the way, and then the couple that make it to the end win. What they win varies between the show. But a few years ago, there was a show that had a little twist upon this dating idea. Not sure if anyone saw this, but it was called The Too Hot to Handle. It was kind of your typical show. In fact, they drew people in, these singles, promising them this kind of paradise type of temptation island idea. But when they got to the island, or when they got to the resort, they said, hey, in order to win this game, you got to resist all temptation. Resist all. You can't kiss, you can't have any sexual touches or any sexual advances, and you cannot satisfy yourself, gratify yourself sexually. You can't do any of that stuff. You have to resist all that, and then if you do, you'll win a prize. It was kind of backwards about these people, because these hot young men wanted nothing more to get it on with their fellow competitors in the game, with whoever would cross their path. In fact, some of these, if you look at the interviews at the beginning of the show, boasted, hey, I'm kind of sexually promiscuous in my life, and so I'm here just to get it all. I'm here to have it, to do it all sexually and whatnot. Their lifestyles were just not that kind of thing. However, when they got to the island, they were told in order to win the prize, they needed to abstain from all these forms of sexual temptation. No kissing, no sexual contact, essential, nothing. And the idea was for them as contestants to get to know the people better, get to know their fellow opposite sex members and whatnot. Kind of a noble concept, almost, dare I say, biblical, but of course this show was anything but biblical. But these hot singles were to resist temptations that for far too many of the other reality shows were thrived upon. I mean, that's what's kind of the things why people like watching these shows many times. So would these couples resist the temptation or give in to their most basic of instincts? Would peer pressure about this winning this prize or threaten this amount of money that they would win encourage them to remain celibate in a way? You see, the show was carefully monitored by cameras, and if they broke any of these rules, if they kissed or they touched each other sexually in inappropriate ways, they would get penalized. The pot would start at one amount, and then slowly that pot would be given away if they did something wrong. And so the idea was, hey, you don't do anything wrong, you get more money at the end, right? Would they be able to do that? Well, you would think they might, but no. They did not. The main motivation was to resist this temptation, but despite the large prize promised to them, not only did they not abstain, most of the time they fell prey to temptation so many times that they just reduced their amount of the payout by half, usually. It's kind of on average. They lost half of their money by all these different temptations that they fell into. There was even one season where there were so many rule violations that took place that they lost all $200,000 of the prize money. Lost it all because of various temptations along the way that they fell into. Before they finally, at the end, oh, we'll give them some money to get back to, just because you earned it back for some reason. Can't remember why. But anyways, we're going to talk about temptation today. Temptation that comes in all shapes and sizes and forms. Everyone here today is tempted in some way or another. We're tempted either to lie or to cheat or have premarital sex or to get married to someone that the Bible says not to or wrong for them. Or there's all kinds of different temptations out there, right? They're all around us. It's part of who we became after Adam and Eve ate that forbidden fruit. Even Jesus on earth faced temptation as he's walking around. He faced these temptations. We read about those in Matthew chapter 4 and Luke chapter 4. The only difference is with Jesus, he was able to resist the temptations and not sin at all and remain pure and sinless. We see this in the book of Hebrews, which says in Hebrews 4:15, "For we do not have a high priest," talking about Jesus in this context, "who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, with our temptations, with our failings as humans. But we have one high priest who's been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet without sin." And because this high priest, Jesus, has been tempted in any way that we are and yet without sin, it goes on to say, we can now approach God's throne with confidence, knowing that we can be forgiven as well because of what Jesus did. So temptations are a way of life. But what are they and how can we overcome them and these desires to do wrong things? Well, last week we started looking at the book of James, and we looked at how James talks to these people who have been scattered out. In fact, James knows all about temptation. He was Jesus' brother, we talked about last week. And so he saw, he witnessed firsthand how his older brother resisted the temptations that he probably most likely fell into. He knew what temptations were and where they came from, and so he started to tell this book given to these messianic Jews scattered around the Roman world what to do and how to live their lives. I told you that the first thing he wanted to do in the first verse of that, or second verse of that book there in James, it says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers, when you face trials of many kinds." We talked about that last week. I won't go into that details. You can listen to that online on our website if you want to listen to that, if you haven't got a chance to. But James wanted the first thing that these Jews to know, scattered around, you're going to face trials in many kinds, and consider it joy. And we talked about what that all meant and why we consider it joy last week. And if you missed, but you might not realize the significance of the word trials. And I highlighted it this morning, and I'll highlight it throughout this message here on my slides. Because the Greek word translated trials has a secondary meaning in Greek. This word is used many, many times in the New Testament. It's used actually over 70 times. And it can be translated actually in two different ways. It can be translated trials or troubles or tribulation or testing in many cases. But it's also translated in a different way that might seem contradictory. James uses actually this word six times in the first chapter of James. And most Bibles accurately translate this verse also, not just trials, but temptation or a trap. And if you look at these two definitions, they kind of seem like they're contradictory, to test or to tempt. What's the difference? And sometimes these testings are temptations, and sometimes our temptations are a test to us. And so it seems to be unique here. But we're going to look at these words this morning and see, as we read through the book of James here, how these words interact and what we can learn from these trials and temptations. What are the differences? What are similarities behind these? So let's start by reading, in chapter 12, or verse 12 of James chapter 1. Now, for those of you who've been following along last week, I skipped over a couple verses that we'll come back to them, verses 9 to 11. We're just going to start here in James chapter 12, and we'll verse 1, and go from here, and I'll come back later on. James writes, "Blessed is a man who perseveres under trials, because when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life that God promised to him to those who loved him. When tempted," same word, "no one should say, 'God is tempting me.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when by his own evil desires he is dragged away and enticed. After desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death." Now there's a lot in these verses here we're going to get into. And we're just going to look at it bit by bit because there's a lot in here, and I lost my place again. Okay, right there. So let me just go back to the first few verses here, and let's look at these in more detail. So you see, James starts off these verses by almost repeating what he says back in the first 8 verses we looked at last week, that you should count it all joy when you're facing trials. And we looked at last week that when we face these trials, they help us grow, it draws us closer to God, and helps clarify our mind. Those are the 3 points from last week. But then he says here, kind of a repeat, he says, blessed are you when you persevere under these trials. And then he gives us the reason, because when he has stood the test, and I want to pause right there because that's a different word for trials or tribulation and testing. It's actually a different Greek word there. It's a word that means you've been tested and proved to be genuine. It's more of those things that, hey, you've passed through the judgment, you've now proven yourself. You've gone through the temptations and trials and are firm. So when he's persevered under these trials and he stood the test of time, he will what? He'll receive the crown of life. The crown of life. So this verse is saying, if we face temptations and trials and temptations and traps for us, we can rejoice because we will once again begin proven to be faithful and true. We'll have great gain. Not only will we have a crown on our Christian walk, grown in our Christian walk and drawn closer to God, we'll be rewarded for our faithfulness. And there's many different rewards that the Bible talks about that will be given to those who are faithful. We saw a lot of these in the book of Revelation, talks about that because that's more toward the end of time when we will see those rewards. And we talked about these, we talked in the book of Revelation several years ago when we went through that series. But the book of Revelation tells us that we'll have white robes in chapter 7-9. We'll be given a new name. We'll be given rest from our labors. It talks about how we'll have our tears wiped away. There will be no more death, no more mourning, crying, or pain. It talks about in 21:21 that we'll walk the streets of gold. Of course, John mentions in other places that we'll be given a mansion, a house prepared for us. And Paul even adds the blessing that will be with the Lord forever. And so there's a lot of rewards to be given to those who have stood the test of time, who have persevered, who have resisted trials and temptations that come in our life. But then he says, James says, he'll receive the crown of life. Now, again, very interesting words behind the Greek here, because there's actually 2 different words for crown in Greek. Now, one is the royal crown, the diadem. We sing about this in the famous hymn, All Hail the Power of Jesus' Name. What's the words here? Bring forth the royal diadem and crown him, Lord, Lord of all. And it's great to him there. But the diadem is a crown that's given to rulers when they are coronated as a king. You know, kings give crowns, or queens give crowns. Actually, a few years ago, I think it was in September of 2022, I think if I remember correctly, we saw this back when King Charles there in England was crowned as king. And actually that day he wore 2 different crowns. I got 2 different crowns up here. It was a St. Edward's crown that he wore at first, and then he switched and wore the imperial state crown. And so these crowns signify royalty. Hey, this is, if you look at the history of these crowns, very historical crowns worn by kings before him. And the symbolism of this royalty, and it's just a wonderful idea of the crown. That's not the word crown of life here in James. That's not the word crown here. We're not being crowned kings and queens of heaven, of the earth, right? But the crown that James mentions here, the crown of life, is a different kind of crown that evokes a different kind of image. Here, coming up in about 6.5 weeks, an international event is going to take place where nations from around the world are going to come together and break dance. Oops. That's supposed to be the... I forgot I was going to tell the person that I had the sound for the Paris Olympics. So, sorry, I was going to blare it out here on the speakers, but anyways. The Paris Olympics are coming here in 6.5 weeks. The Olympic Games happens every 4 years. And there's actually going to be breakdancing this year in the Olympic Games, I'm told, so watch for that. But anyways, the Paris Olympics, It's a game where contestants from around the world come, athletes come, and have prepared for their lifetime for this one event. They come and compete, and they earn these medals. This is a kind of picture of the medals that they're going to look like this year in Paris. I got that off the internet this morning. And so they get these medals. And so it's a great picture here of this, but back in biblical times, athletes didn't compete for medals like this. They competed for this. It's a crown of laurel wreaths. This is the crown, same word that's used here in James. So the picture that these readers of the book of James would say, hey, you're going to get to the end of time. You're going to be found true and faithful. You're going to have been through the testings and trials and been proven true, and you're going to get the crown of life, this victor's crown, this crown that you've made it. You see, only the victors, only the most elite athletes in the world would get these kind of crowns. This crown signifying that you competed in the toughest, hardest, most intense competition known to mankind, the Olympics, and you came out on top. You're victorious. This is the image of the crown that would evoke with these readers here. That only if you're good enough to qualify and become a winner in the Olympic Games would you receive this crown. And James says, hey, for Christians, this crown is going to be given to us to all who believe and who long for his coming, right? This is the crown that we are desiring. James is saying this crown of life is given to those who persevere, not in an athletic competition, but in the race of life. James is comparing the Olympic and the trials and tribulations to our everyday life. You see, when we stood the test of time and have persevered through it, we'll be given this crown of victory and of celebration. This is the crown of life that we strive for. This is our goal in life, just as much as athletes train around the world to get these gold medals. Years and years to compete. This is what justifies all the hardships that these athletes had gone through. All these things that they've trained for. Things that they had endured to make it to the point where they received the crowns. In fact, just back in, I think it was 2004, when they had the Olympic Games back in Athens, they actually gave out laurel wreaths like this for the athletes. And you can have pictures online that you can see the victors had that crown upon their head. They sometimes do flowers nowadays. But back in Athens there in 2004, and I think they brought it back in other games, but I didn't find it. But anyways, 2004, they had these laurel wreaths given to the victors. And I kind of like this picture. I really love this picture. Because this is something we can strive for in our godly daily lives. You see, we're not competing for the best breakdancer or the best runner or best shot putter or whatever it might be. We're competing in a game of life, not against each other, but against what the world wants for us to do. We're being tried many times. We're being tempted in many ways, trying to get us away from the path, the training that God wants for us. And we all struggle in life. And if we continue our struggle and we don't give up, if we continue all the way to the end, it says we'll be crowned. We'll be given these gold medals, in a sense, and a recognition that we've made it to the end, victorious and won this prize. And this is not the only place in the Bible that talks about this crown. Again, like I said, this word crown is used many different times. Paul uses it in 1 Corinthians 9:25. He says, everyone who competes in the games, talking about the Olympic games there, goes into strict training. They do it to get a crown, same word, this crown, that will not last. Again, these leaves are just going to fade away eventually. But we do it for a crown that lasts forever. Paul says something very similar in 2 Timothy 2:5. He says, similarly, if anyone competes as an athlete, he doesn't receive the victor's crown, the crown of the laurel wreaths, unless he competes according to the rules. Just a couple chapters later, he kind of picks up this metaphor, and he says in chapter 4, verse 7, I've fought the fight, I've finished the race, I've kept the faith. Now there is in store for me again, that crown. The crown of righteousness, he calls it here, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award me on that day, and not only for me, but also to all who long for his appearing. We're looking forward for this crown of righteousness. This righteousness, this righteous crown that will be given to all those who long for his appearing. And even Peter, not just Paul or James, but also Peter gets into the throng of this crown idea. It says in 1 Peter 5:4, when the chief shepherd appears, when Jesus appears, you'll receive a crown of glory that will never fade away. We talk about glory to his name here. Where are we getting this glory? That will never fade away. It's not one of these temporary earthly crowns that will wither and die, but that we will receive that crown of righteousness, this crown of glory that'll make all the trials and tribulations here on earth worth it. And just a quick note, if I can pick it up here real quick, this is also the same word for crown. Again, it doesn't look like a glorious laurel wreath that you get at the Olympic Games, but Jesus was victorious. And that crown of victory was his as well. He deserved much more, but we'll talk about that some other time. So let's not become discouraged when we go through trials in our lives, when we go through tough times, when we are tested in our faith, when people buffet us the wrong way because of our beliefs in Jesus. They're just preparing us for a great blessing. They're showing us that we can endure to the end and receive that wonderful, glorious crown and the words, well done, good and faithful service. And this is why, going back to the verses that I skipped here, why James adds this between the beginning of the chapter where he talks about considering all joy when you face trials and when you persevere, you'll have this crown of life. He puts these verses, James 1:9-11. He says, the brother in humble circumstances ought to take pride in his high position, but the one who is rich shall take pride in his low position, because he will pass away like a wildfire flower. For the sun rises with scorching heat and withers the plant, its blossoms falls, and its beauty is destroyed. In the same way, the rich man will fade away even when he goes about his business. Now, why does James add this in there? Well, this is kind of a picture. He said, hey, we need to be humbled, because when we're humbled because of our testing, we can take pride in that, because we're actually being lifted up to a high position, because God is trying us and testing us through these trials to give us this crown, this high position. And in the same way, if you're rich or successful and you're humbled by God and by these trials and tribulations and whatnot, you can take pride in that as well. Because you're brought low, God's going to raise you back up. He should take pride in this low position, because he's been counted, that God can count him as worthy. So don't be discouraged by how much we have or how much we earn. Just take pride in how God treats you as his child, as a tried and true son of him. You see, if left on our own, without trials to humble us, we'll be like wildfires, flowers that grow and quickly fade away. Like Paul says, that earthly crown is just going to fade away. So to see God's work in our life, trials must come, persecution must come, in order for the goodness and life to be seen in the hereafter. But when troubles are put upon our lives that help us grow, sometimes we look at them not as good things. I talked about this kind of a little bit last week. We think, oh, why am I going through these trials? Why am I going through these tribulations? Why am I going through all this testing? And we might question who God is. And this is what James then goes on to say, because some people might be tempted to say, well, God is doing this to me. God is the one that's persecuting me. God's the one that's tempting me to do all these bad things. James says clearly, starting in verse 13, that when tempted, when tested, when going through trials, no one should say, God is doing this. God is tempting me. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. And again, this is kind of confusing here, if you're reading this and you know the background, because you know that the Bible does say in various places that God does test people sometimes. He tested Abraham, it says in Genesis 22:1, by asking him to sacrifice his son Isaac. It says very clearly, God tested Abraham. God tried Abraham, tempted Abraham essentially. Exodus 15:25 says that God tested the children of Israel while they were wandering in the wilderness, where they would be faithful to him. And Job in Job 23:10 says that God is testing me. And so how can God test us and yet not tempt us? What is the nuance here? It's all in how we perceive what the trial is, what the temptation is, how we look at it. You see, if we look at our sufferings as things that help us grow, things that might help us get to be more like God, as we talked about last week, these good things, these trials and tribulations will result in good results. But if we look at them negatively or as opportunities to do evil or try to get ahead by giving into our sins and our desires, they are considered temptations. It's all about our perceptions of the events that transpire our lives. If something is good for us or something that we need to resist, it's based upon our own desires to either grow or a stumbling block for us to stumble over. And this is what James goes on to say. James 1, verse 14 goes on to say, when each one is tempted or tried or tested, all these different words can be inputted here, when each one is tempted, when by his own evil desires he is dragged away and enticed. Again, I like that picture of things. He's dragged away and enticed. Then after his desire has conceived, has given birth, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is full grown, it gives birth to death. You see, these temptations don't come from God in order to make us fail and fall and give in to our evil desires. Our temptations come from us. Each one of us are tempted by our own desires. Many of the temptations, if we're honest with ourselves, come from ourselves, don't they? They're our desires, our longings, our cravings. And this is where temptations come from. You see, it's easy to find someone to blame or a way out. Well, God made me do this. Or what I hear oftentimes, the devil made me do it. Oh, that makes it all better. The devil made me do it, so therefore it's okay. I remember there's a book that I've read one time. Its title was, If the Devil Made You Do It, Then You Blew It. And so it's one of those things. Hey, yeah, if you think the devil made you, actually it's not that case. It's your own evil desires. It's your own sinful nature. It's the things you look at as trying to get ahead. That's what temptations are. It's trying to do something in order to surpass God, essentially. God's not doing this the right way. He's making me face all these things, so I'm going to do something to do it my own way. My own desires, my own longings. You see, God intends each test to grow us, to mature us. He never wants us to fall short. His test gives us, the tests he gives us make us better and not put us a stumbling block in our way. This is why God never intends to tempt us with our trials. It's because of our sinful desires that temptation comes. This temptation is from us. We are the ones, James says here, that cause us to be tempted by our own evil desires. And they drag us away. Again, a very picturesque term. Drag us away because we're enticed. We see things better on this side than what God has in store for us. And we want to get here instead of taking the heat under God's growth for our lives. We think if we only get what the good things are over here, then we'll be better and temptation will just... But God says, hey, you need to learn. Perseverance, kind of those type of things. The quick type of thing. Or for athletes. Again, talking about the Olympic athletes. Olympic athletes have to train their whole lives. And yet there's a temptation to take steroids or other enhancing drugs and whatnot to get ahead faster, better. And they won't receive the crown if they fall into those temptations. They need to work, train, build their muscles, build their endurance. Same is true in the Christian life. We cannot get rich quick in the Christian life. We cannot get the good things without going through the sufferings. Those trials come, and yet the temptation is to just bypass all that. We don't want the trials. We don't want the temptation. They're bad. They're evil. No, they help us grow. It's the evil things on the other side. So it's two sides of the same coin. God is not testing us. He's or is testing us, not tempting us. And God is not tempting us, he's testing. And so we see this struggle that we have in our lives, these battles that we fall prey to. Should we give in to our desires, our natural tendencies to do things, or should we follow God's way? Paul in the book of Romans, he read this a couple weeks ago in chapter 7, says the same very thing. Here says in Romans 7:18, I have the desire to do good, or have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do not want to do, it's always confusing here. Let me read this very closely here. I have the desire to do what is good, but I cannot carry it out. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. Right? Now, if I do what I do not want to do, it is no longer I who do it, but the sin living in me that does it. It's, again, that same idea that James is saying here. It's our evil desires. It's a sin living in us that want to do the things that we know we shouldn't do. And Paul is struggling here in chapter 7, and he actually ends his chapter by saying, woe is me! Who can help this? What's the word here? This wretched man that I am, right? Who can save me from this body of death, he says there in Romans 7:28, I believe. To which he answers, thanks be to God, because I know that Jesus came and died for me. It talks about the resurrection and how we need to, in chapter 8, be living testimonies to Jesus, right? This is the good we ought to do, and yet we find ourselves being tempted many times away, doing our evil desires. And James says, this is going to lead to death. You know, when we are tempted away, it conceives, gives birth, and eventually ends in death. So do not blame God or blame Satan for what you're facing, either your trials or your temptations. Instead, see the result of our fallen state and say, hey, we need to correct what's wrong with us. And we need to follow God's way. Instead of giving in to our desires, our fallen state, resist and give your body to God. And this brings us to the final part of this chapter, because it talks about God giving us gifts and good gifts, because it kind of puts a cap on this whole idea of how we should view our trials and temptations, that these trials that come our way are, again, good things. James says in verse 16, do not be deceived, dear brothers. Every good and perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of heavenly lights, who does not change like shifting shadows. He chose to give us birth through the word of truth, that we might be the kind of first groups that he created. You see, all the good things that God gives to us come from God. Even the things that we might think are bad, these trials, these things that are tempting us away, are God's way of proving us, God's way of saying, hey, you need to train and get your spiritual bodies to be given that crown of life. Don't be tempted away. Don't try to take the shortcuts or the easy way out. Things that God gives us are good. You've been reading through our daily reading through the Bibles. We saw a similar idea in Romans chapter 14. And I'm not sure exactly what verse it was. I tried to look it up here this last week, but I read it and I need to put that in my sermon, but I couldn't find it again. But Paul's talking in Romans 14 about different foods and different days. Should we treat different foods different ways? Should we eat only certain things and not eat certain other things, or treat other days as holy and not? And how Paul is just saying, hey, all these things came from God. So why should we argue over incidental things in our Christian walk? Why should we have to worry about what day to worship on or what to eat? You know, God created it all. So if you feel in your heart that you can eat certain foods, then eat certain foods, he concludes there in chapter 14. And likewise, if you treat certain days as holy and other people don't get a big deal over it, because God intended all of them for good. So we need to thank God for the trials that we face in life, for the hard times that come our way. We can thank him for all the good gifts that he's given to us, because It's intended not for us to be tempted away, but for us to be tested. For us to be tried, and not just tried and tested, but had that result of being true to Him. Because that's what happens with in our lives. When we think of our trials and temptations, that we need to realize that they're God's gifts to us, to grow us, to draw us closer to Him, to help us have that clarity of mind that we looked at last week. And the temptations that many of us face are just those desires that we need to get rid of. The desires that we see in our lives. So do we resist the way which God wants us to grow, or do we see it as a way of helping us grow when we face these trials? Do we see the things that God brings along as gifts to help us grow, or temptations to lead us astray? If we see them as troubles, we may want to avoid them or have these desires that will lead to death. But instead, we need to strive for that crown of life. Make that our goal. Make that our mission. Say, hey, God, I want to be faithful to you. I want to run that race that Paul talks about and receive that crown. Faithful to the end. Strive for that crown of life. Strive for that goal in your life as you draw close to Him and as He draws close to you.